We're continuing in our study of the New Testament letter to the Romans, and we'll be in that for quite a while, I imagine. We are at chapter 1, verse 18, if you want to get your Bibles available to that, and I want to introduce it a little bit. I want to ask a question to open our thoughts concerning this. Have you ever experienced the value of being shown an error? Have you ever experienced the value of being shown an error? My first illustration is a little bit lighthearted, but let's imagine a certain fellow who's just come across a damsel in distress in a parking lot, and her van's battery is dead. And so she stands in need of a jump start, and he happens to have cables. And inexplicably, his interest in helping is fairly strong. She's rather attractive, and my family's laughing. What's the problem here? His desire to help is strong, but there's a silent undercurrent in him of just a little bit of nervousness, because inside himself he says, I'm always not sure I remember how to do this, to put the battery cables on properly. And he says to himself, you know, all guys are supposed to know this, right? And when you hook it up, one cable is supposed to go to the frame or something, right? Because that's guys who know do it. Who puts the cables both on the, you know, on the terminals? Somebody does it to the frame. Guys who know. But wait a minute. I think I'm okay with this, because if, as long as I go, you know, one thing to one thing, the other thing to the other thing, and keep them lined up, it's going to work out okay. Doesn't even matter if the colors match up, because she's probably not going to know where the colors match up anyway. So I'm going to be okay. Be confident. See, that's all on the inside, and it's all happening in a split second. On the outside, it's, I'll save you. You know, here I am. But inside, again, it's just keep it the same. Okay, black. What's that phrase? Black to positive. I think, okay, black to positive, and get it all hooked up. You go to the other end. And you pick it up. You don't want to touch them together. You're very careful. Hands on the rubber, you know, things, and not the metal. Don't touch them together. And you look at the other battery, and you say, there are the red cables. Red, okay. And there is smoke. And there's instantaneous heat all up and down the cable. You could hardly touch it. And there's arc welding. And here's my question. Would it have been better for him if he had been shown his error? You can ask me later whether it has anything to do with me, anything to do with a certain damsel named Lori, anything to do with last week. But the important thing is, would it have been better to be shown my error? God's grace, I think, came in to bear it. I don't think it's any damage to either vehicle, but whatever. Let me ask a deeper question. I do start out lightheartedly, but let me ask a deeper question. Is there value to being shown fault? Not just blunder. Is there a value to being shown fault? I'm talking value. Do you understand? Like, it would be worth it to be shown fault. The psalm writer in Psalm 119, there's a section of it. It's a big, long psalm, right? There's a section of it, right around verse 70, where he says an interesting thing. He shows the value of his own having been shown his fault. It's an interesting section, because there's a beautiful part to that section of Psalm 119. The writer says, I've come to learn that God's commands for my life are valuable. They're worthwhile. I mean, even his, just in the inner sense, spiritual sensibilities, he has discovered value. They've become precious to him. Imperfectly, of course, but in a real way, this writer, Psalm 119, had come to love the commands of God. But you realize as you read the section that it hadn't always been that way. and that there was a learning process, and that it was not an easy learning process. So he writes, though, and this is something not everyone appreciates, and he looked around him and he realized that there are many who did not appreciate God's commands, who were actually callous to them and didn't even realize there was a problem, committing drastic sins but not really being too disturbed inside. He saw that out there, but he remembered his own situation. And he writes in Psalm 119, verse 71, "It was good for me. It was good for me to be afflicted so that I might learn your decrees." Verse 67 says about the same thing. "Before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I obey your word." And he's happy about it. You see, he's making a very direct connection. He was not obeying, and he suffered. He was corrected. He was confronted. But he learned, and now he was deeply happy before God that he'd learned the value of God's ways. Is it good to be shown even fault? I know it's good to be shown blunder, especially before it happens. You can be corrected before it happens. Is it good to be shown even fault? Yes, says the writer of Psalm 119. One deeper question yet before we read this. Would it be good to discover that you were alienated from God, if in fact you were? Do you know what I'm asking? Imagine a real scenario where someone is alienated from God. They have alienated themselves from God by their unbelief and by their sin. Would it be good to know? In that hypothetical scenario, what if this person were both alienated but insensitive to it, didn't feel very, very far from God in their own reckoning of it, but were actually alienated from God by their sin? Would it be good for them to discover it? What if by their own sort of distorted way of thinking about the world, really God's world, their own way of selfish desires, their own attitudes, their own actions, they had distanced themselves from the Maker and didn't know it? And think about this too. All of this is in preparation for reading from Romans 1, so you understand that. What if it were perfectly reasonable and not unfair at all for God to let a person go his own way, even if it were to bitter end? Wouldn't it be good rather to be confronted, rather to have eyes opened and become sensitive? Wouldn't it be good, even if it were hard, a hard reality to swallow? Wouldn't it be good, even if it involved humbling, great humbling, even if it caused that person to discover faults they wouldn't even admit to themselves, even if there were pain in that discovery, wouldn't it be good to know? Might it not be, in fact, refreshment and hope? We're walking along through the thoughts involved in this letter. Paul's writing a letter to these folks. The very next thing we're going to hear him say, verse 18, we've made it to there, right? Next verse we hit. He's going to say, "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven." There's a popular topic, you know. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven. But I ask you, if there really is such a thing as the wrath of God, and if that wrath of God were directed toward you, wouldn't it be good to know? In fact, I think such passages as this are full of mercy because they let people know for the sake of their redemption. I start this way being very direct in my address because that's where the rubber meets the road. I think if we want to talk about the context, Paul is addressing a very particular situation here. He's addressing how, at least in these first few chapters, how the Jews thought of the Gentiles, because among certain of the Jews, there would have been sort of a default conclusion about Gentiles. They're outside, they're not at peace with God, and maybe that already begins to, as he addresses them, begins to reveal sort of the direction Paul's going to go with this. But the reason, he starts out here, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men, etc., etc. I think the reason it applies to you and me is because of where Paul will go in his discussion with them. It's very specifically a specific circumstance, but what he says to them, we must learn from. Do you know what he's going to tell them? Romans chapter 1, second half, as it flows into chapters 2 and 3. To those who were confident in their own righteousness because of their own sense of their good works, and to those who looked over at others saying, these folks probably do not measure up, or whatever it is they would say, the Apostle Paul, in effect, is going to say to them, do you realize that you yourself are not righteous in your own self? You need a solution. Have you realized your own jeopardy when the issue to consider is the wrath of God? So I think what happens here, Paul raises a truth that we've got, every one of us has to face. The wrath of God is real. We have to ask ourselves how that relates to us. And I said last week that it seems to me that, generally speaking, very few folks face that question directly, earnestly, gravely. In common society, at least in our experience of our own culture, I think very few people deal with it gravely, seriously, straight on, face on, the wrath of God. I thought I could illustrate that by saying, what if you could picture yourself doing this? I'm not asking you to do it this week. Picture yourself going to Costco, going to McDonald's, going to anywhere, you know, in town, and just walk up to a stranger and say, look, hi, excuse me, sir, I've got a little questionnaire. It's only one question long. It's kind of got two parts. Would you be willing to answer a question that has to do with what people think about religion? Guy says, shoot, go ahead. I don't care. Sure, one question, I can handle that. And you say to him, tell me what you understand of the wrath of God and how it relates to you. I'm trying to picture that. Again, I'm not asking you to do that this week. But picture, what would that go like at Costco? You know? I do mean really. I don't mean only hypothetically. I mean, what would that conversation go like if it got past, you know, just saying, get out of my face, or something like that. Many, many people would answer that question. Really, they would. I went into public malls for 36 weeks in a row when I was in seminary, asking questions, not exactly like that, but something like that. People will talk to you. But the thing is, what would they say? What do you understand of the wrath of God and how it relates to you? One more thing before we get into the reading of this. I want you to know that this does talk about the wrath of God. It talks about sins. You could count them. There's 19 or 20 sins listed here. If you count real carefully, you might come up with 22. I don't know. But there's a number of sins, and we could get lost in the lists of sins. Certain of these sins will catch your eye as being among the deplorable sins. Right? Even if you walked out into Costco and they said, which of these are the worst? You know, somebody go, oh man, oh brother, you know, murder is here, malice is here, certain sins of perversion, sexual sins, things like that. Which are the worst? And people might say, you know, but I also think, as people consider a list, you just, here we're going to read it, right? as people consider lists like this, I wonder if on the inside sometimes there's a certain calculation that begins to go on. Well, I wonder if I'm on the list of the worst ones. You know, I've got this one, but that's a little one, and this is a big one, and so I wonder if I'm on the big list, you know, for the bad, you know, and the worst sins. I want us to approach this in a certain way because of the way it's written. Listen carefully on this. Every item in the list that we're going to find here, again, 19, 20, 22, every item in the list is shown in Paul's reasoning, it's shown three times over, to be the result of a more fundamental problem than any one of them in the list could claim. Does that make sense? Three times over, the Apostle Paul will help us to understand that the list items, all and every one of them, come out of a more fundamental problem than any list item could claim. Paul's reasoning will go like this. You see, it's because of the fundamental problem that God has turned people over to act this way and this way and this way. What I want to talk about is the fundamental problem. If there's a problem that's at the root and the core, if there's a problem from which all the problems come, I want to know what that is and what role it plays in this whole mess and mix. Let me read Romans chapter 1, verses 18 on through the end of the chapter. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God's made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified Him as God nor gave thanks to Him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. Therefore, God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator who's forever praised. Amen. Because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts. Even their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, the men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed indecent acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their perversion. Furthermore, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, He gave them over to a depraved mind, to do what ought not be done. They've become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They're full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. They're gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They are senseless, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these very things, but also approve of those who practice them. How's that for a passage to preach on this week? And isn't it interesting? Do you remember how he started this letter? This is not very far into the letter. Do you know how he started the letter? My calling in life is to bring good news from God. I am set apart for this, the good news of God. Isn't it interesting that he begins this way? What shall we say before he gets to the good part? I'm convinced, reading it this way, that this has to be understood. This aspect has to be understood. And then the fullness of the good news and forgiveness of God and acceptance by God can be understood. Who are the folks being talked about in this, by the way? Right? He keeps using the word they. They are this way, you know. They don't glorify God as God. They don't give thanks. Their thinking is futile. Their hearts are darkened. God gave them over to such sinful desires and shameful lusts and depraved mind. At first, you might be thinking, as you're reading it, well, you know, they're in Rome. They're thinking of somebody. Maybe it's a group. Maybe it's people alive at the time. But very early on, as you read, you realize, oh, who are they? Do you know what I'm going to say? They are a mess, whoever they are, right? They are a mess. Who are they? Suddenly you realize he's talking about people from creation to the present. He's talking about the human race. He's talking about everybody. This is the most sweeping indictment in the scriptures. It includes everyone. How do I know that? It's the way that the flow of his thought goes. Since the creation of the world, things that should be known about God have been made clear by God. Therefore, man is without excuse. That's the broad use, you see. Mankind, the whole human race. Although they, mankind, there are things about God they should have known. And God made them clear. But they did these other things. I want to get this. I don't want to miss anything. Back again to this. The letter is going to be about hope. But somehow this has to be learned first. The letter is going to be about hope. And the only thing we have time today to address really with any thoroughness is the fundamental problem. And I want to describe that fundamental problem by summary. Some of these phrases here, I want to collect them. Do you see that the fundamental problem is that they've not glorified God as God? They've not really dealt with him for who he is. They've not been thankful, it says. And they have exchanged. I think that's such a crucial word in understanding this passage. They have exchanged the very glory of God for lesser things. More worthless things. The very glory of God, which they should have known, they could have benefited, they exchanged for lesser things. Worshipping, you know, chunks of wood that they fabricated. Chunks of pieces of metal formed. And they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. Do you see what the change is? God who is glorious, God who is truth, they exchanged that for a lie. They did not retain the knowledge of God. These things describe the fundamental problem. And then out of those things come the succumbing to sinful desires, the degrading of themselves, the doing of what ought not be done, all kinds of greed and wickedness and malice, heartlessness, ruthlessness, all things in the list. The one is the cause of the other. Does it make sense? That the one is the root that exchanged God for things they're going to invest themselves in these other things. In our culture, the actual setting up of an idol is not as prominent right around us as it was there. It's very prominent in the world still. Very prominent across the globe. And sure, it does happen in the United States, but it's not as quite as familiar. But still, the issues are the same. If one were to turn from God's way and invest themselves in a worthless thing to get, whether it be pleasures, or satisfactions, or whatever. It is, this passage defines all of that as idolatry. You know, you think, this sounds like a pretty negative passage. Did you see how many positive things are in it? All of which people exchange for worthless things. This passage, this brick in the face sort of passage, what does it mention? The power of one who has the very power of creation. Divine power. Eternal power. Glory. One who could be thanked because there's cause for thanksgiving. Light as opposed to darkness. Wisdom as opposed to foolishness. Truth as opposed to lies. Immortality. Some cause for eternal praise, lasting praise. Things that are natural. Things we were created for. Things that are good. All of that's mentioned here too. All of it coming from who God is, all of it exchanged in the most fundamental problem that the world has. I've often thought about this in terms of how people deal with what they perceive to be the most important of God's various commands. Again, we're with the random survey. This time we're at, I don't know, put us somewhere, Costco again. Random survey. You walk up to somebody and say, what do you think are the worst offenses? We're thinking about God. It's a religious question. The God who made the world. What are the worst kinds of offenses? And have you offended God in any of these? Again, what might that conversation go like? Really? And I mean really. Can you think? Asking the genuine question, just walking up to somebody, asking the question, what do you think are the worst kinds of offenses? And have you offended in anything or the worst kinds? Maybe that's asking the question in a certain way, you know, setting up a straw man. But what is offense? What is bad? What is worse? I really very fully imagine that if people were asked that question, they would begin to calculate whether they've committed any of the real bad sins. The malicious ones, the murderous ones, the hateful ones, the corrupt ones. And here's the second aspect of that. Don't you think that folks, I say this in part because I have experience with it. We used to ask the question as part of Evangelism Explosion. We used to ask the question, if you were actually to face God, let's imagine that, you know, something happened and you died and had to face God, what, and he were to ask you, you know, why should I accept and let you into this? What would you say? And again, I asked hundreds of people that question, I think, in the course of 36 weeks, or maybe not hundreds, some number of people. High percentages, probably way up in the 90s of percentiles, people began to calculate the degree of their errors. Was it really bad or just a little bad? Almost no one would say they hadn't sinned. You know, well, no, nobody said that to me, ever. But they would begin to calculate, should God accept me after I died? It was all a matter of calculation, you know, well into the high 90s of percentile of time. But how many would consider this? What if the most fundamental kind of offense to God and the offense from which all others come had to do with this, had to do with whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind, and with all your strength? Do you think that would be a common answer? What is offense to God? What is bad? What is crippling sort of offense to God? Do you think you would commonly get the response, basically, it's you've broken the very greatest commandment if you have not loved the Lord your God, to love Him. I think that's perhaps one of the most difficult things for people in our age and culture to see, is their need for a Savior. Because when you do the calculation thing, you don't come out that bad. You think, well, I haven't. I mean, sometimes you will. But on it, for many that you would come up with, they'd say, I'm not that bad. And I honestly think as you talk to someone about that, it's not the best place to go with them in your reasoning with them to identify something you're almost certain they've committed. Did you ever lie? Did you ever steal a paperclip from the office? You know, to find some sin and say, I know they're bad on this one, so I'll tell them, they'll have to admit it, I'll say you've broken the law of God and you need a savior. I honestly think it's more, I mean, we could talk about all that theologically and specifically, but I think it's more productive to ask about the fundamental thing, the thing at the heart and soul and core of it all. Have you fallen short in the command that Jesus Christ himself said was the greatest command? Have we fallen short there? Have we loved the Lord our God with all our heart and soul and mind and strength? Everything else comes out of that. And that's, I think, why Jesus said that's the greatest command. Love the Lord your God. Even the second greatest command comes from the first one. You know, love your neighbor as yourself. That flows out of the more fundamental thing. So I am not trying to diminish the sentence against any sin that's on those lists. You know, whether it be gossip or anything. Gossip, malice, strife, envy. I'm not trying to diminish any of those and say those are the little ones and this is the big one. But I think we've just got to go to the root and ask, from where does envy come? From where does heartlessness come? And three times over, it would seem here that it comes in three sections. I mean, it comes in various ways a bunch of times. But it seems to be coming from turning our worship away from God and investing ourselves in lesser things. If I invest myself in revenge, which is against his law, maybe I think I'm going to gain a satisfaction, but what have I given up? I've given up the glorious one who is all justice to go get my revenge. What if I go out to find satisfaction in an illicit relationship? I have given up all satisfaction in the one who provides for me my whole humanity and who I am. He's provided that for me. And I turn away from his law to go get my satisfaction elsewhere. The issue is the idolatry. The issue is I'm turning my worship away and investing it elsewhere. There's where I'll get my needs met. There's where I'll be satisfied or whatever. And I think Romans 1 is all about that. All about that. Because eventually, again, what he's going to say to the Jews who are working hard at the law of God, as they understand it, certain ones, I mean, thinking themselves righteous because they've got the law in their hands, they're trying hard, I'm pretty pious, I'm working hard at this. He's going to say to them, you have no excuse. You look over there at the Gentiles and you say, now they're the lost ones and I've got God's law and I'm the saved one. But he's going to say, you need your righteousness from outside of yourself. I'm summarizing a lot in Romans by there. But that, if it's going to get to good news, and I sure hope it gets to some good news, right? If it's going to get to good news, it will do so this way. We've got to take out every ounce of your confidence in your own righteousness. You know, gossip is on the same list with murder. Not because you can say gossip is exactly the same as murder in its ultimate weight in the cosmos and all of that. Not that. But it comes from the same root, and the root is the problem. And from the root of the problem has come death into the world, and from the root of the problem has come separation from God. We need to turn back to God and find the good news where it can be found. It cannot be found in saying, I'll try harder now. I'll try to gossip less, envy less, be less hateful, etc., etc., etc. It will say, okay, I have learned my lesson. I must find my righteousness outside of myself. The Lord can give a wonderful transformation. He's all about the new creation of people who will act righteously. But as far as finding myself in His judgment safe, accepted there, I must not find that in my own righteousness, which the brick in the face passage devastates and says it's everybody and you need righteousness from someplace else. Let's pray.